Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
It's not just Washington that is broken. It's America who is asleep at the wheel. Why do they tell us that the Constitution is outdated? Can you outdate liberty? This is Brett Rappaport, and you are listening to the Final Say Radio Show. Everybody, welcome back to the Final Say Radio Show with Brett and John Rappaport and Andrew on the boards. We're happy. Well, we're happy. That is going to be happy Thanksgiving tomorrow. Everybody gets a day off, and of course, we're going to take a day off as well and enjoy some time with the family, which is certainly much needed. And I hope you're doing the same. And Thanksgiving is one of my favorite days of the year for several reasons. It's not just the turkey and the stuffing and the mashed potatoes and the and all the good stuff that comes with it, but just, spending time with your friends, your family, your whatever, watching some good football, hopefully, and I guess a lot of us are going to be enjoying possibly some snow and a little colder than usual, but that's okay. It's all good. It's all good, folks. We have an interview today with Alvaro Vargas Llosa, who we've had on the program before. He's a fellow at the Independent Institute, and he has a book that he put out last year, Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. Very good book. I certainly recommend it. You could pick it up from the Independent Institute or just Google it. I'm sure you can get it at any of the bookstores as well, Amazon or Barnes & Noble or whatnot. But it's just a great read, and a lot of very interesting things, interesting stories. He has actually taken the time to go on some of the routes that a lot of the people who cross the border take, and gained a lot of valuable insight and information doing so. And as I said, you gain a lot of understanding and information from the book. Whether you agree with everything he's saying or not, doesn't really matter. This is how we learn. This is how we study. This is how we come, improve each day, is becoming an expert, increasing our expertise on various policies. And, of course, reading your own kind isn't going to get you there, because you got to read opposing thoughts and different ideas. So brings me to a couple things before we have Alvaro join us. But here's a thought I had. I was listening to, I listen to other shows and interviews, and interesting conversation between John Batchelor, Larry Kudlow, and James Petacoukas. And they had mentioned a guy who had passed away, Backer. I can't think of his first name. Anyway, he had this idea, mimicking a system that was similar to some other countries like Canada or Germany or whatnot. And so I did a little calculation. We allow approximately, let's call it about 1 million people are given, a chance to come here every year and eventually become citizens. Some are just, given a path, they're given their green cards, whatever, to, do what they have to do to become citizens. I'm not an expert on that, on how it exactly works, because, I was born here. Anyway, it's hard enough staying here, too, by the way. I mean, all the paperwork you got to constantly fill out to prove you are who you are anyway. But that's besides the point. So let's just say you have 1 million. Now, I just want to make sure I'm doing the math here correctly, so I'm going to do it again. So you have 1 million people. Let's just suppose that you had a visa program where you sold a visa for $10,000. Now, some people might be able to buy it outright, and some people may have to pay it off. But that's okay. We could handle that. So let's just say 1 million people, and you sell a Visa for $10,000. Well, when I do the math, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's $10 billion. I hope. Anyway, and I'll do it again just to make sure. But what I'm getting at is, instead of just giving away the farm like we always do, $10 billion. So instead of giving away the farm and just giving people who violated our laws something for nothing, you know, pretending like we're doing them a favor, or in the case of the whatever Obama had filled anyway, it's only a temporary solution. It doesn't really solve any of these people's problems. So it doesn't work. So my idea is, if you could raise, you know, $10, $15 billion a year. Now, keep in mind, you have upwards of 10 or 11 million people here. And, of course, we need to find every one of them. And I'm sorry, but even the ones that refuse to come forward, then there has to be an ultimatum. You either come forward so we can figure out who you are and if you do belong here, or if we catch you, you're going to spend a year in prison camp, a hard labor camp, and then we're going to deport you to wherever we figure out you came from anyway. So you got to make it to, like, kind of like what we should have done when Iran to prevent the nuke program. You know, sanctions that bring an economy to their absolute knees is what we should have done instead. But, you know, Obama's only capable of bringing his own economy or his own country to its knees, not others. Anyway, so the point is, if you could raise $10 billion a year selling visas, I would imagine that would account for a fair amount of the cost of these people coming here. And of course, the idea is to set up a free market, if you will, of, well, how do we decide who comes here? Let's not just put a quota and say, well, we're going to take 1,000 people from this country and 10,000 from there and 50,000 from here. Let's look at what our markets need, what different areas need. In other words, when people initially come here, it's not just like, hey, we're all going to New York. Well, I'm sorry, there's not the opportunity and the call for all these people is not in New York. It may be that you have a listing of, you know, we've got, you know, 1,000 openings in St. Louis and 50,000 in L.A. and whatever it is, however you break it down. Somebody has the opportunity, first come, first serve, I guess, or you do it by lottery, something like that. And you say, well, here's your three options. Pick which one you'd like. Pay your fee. If you can't pay it all at once, you could pay it off in 5 years, you know, $2,000 a year or whatever it is, and it comes out of your paycheck by whatever job or whatever that you're actually sponsored. So basically, we're setting up a system where somebody can gain access to a job that's needed and opened. And in some cases, these people are just, maybe it's someone's grandma who's coming over. And in that case, the family's going to have to sponsor someone and just ensure that these people will be taken care of by the families. Because what I'm trying to do is establish a system where, instead of just adding more people to the roles of our social programs, we want to add people to adding value and value added to our economy. And I think if we do that, I think a lot of the naysayers would be more in favor. And it's about time we started making positives instead of negatives anyway. Anyway, so Alvaro's going to be joining us in just a second, and so let's... Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have our first guest on the program today, and I want to welcome back to the Final Say Radio Show, Alvaro Vargas Llosa, who's a senior fellow at the Independent Institute, but he's also the author of Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America, a wonderful book which addresses so many important issues with regards to immigration. But it's also a very educational book on a lot of, you know, I guess history, if you will, or just ideas that encompass migration and immigration. So, Alvaro, it's a pleasure to have you back on a program, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Alvaro, you obviously spent a lot of effort and time into this book, And there are many different topics to discuss, but one thing that really caught me at the beginning in your opening monologue of the book was just the discussion of the border towns and the routes and the paths that a lot of these people take when they're crossing from, you know, wherever they may be. You know, they cross over usually from Mexico, what we're talking about, but they could be from anywhere. And then, you know, they can come into California or Arizona, as you discussed in great length, or Texas or New Mexico. And I thought it was very interesting. And the part that really caught my attention were the involvement of the gangs or drug lords or things of that nature. And then, of course, how members of various churches or whatnot or religious institutions worked to try to help facilitate not only the crossing but the safety of these people and try to ensure that they were able to deal with and cope with things such as crossing the desert and some of the things that they would face along the way.
Sure. I mean, well, that's one of the more, I would say, kind of sinister and at the same time fascinating aspects of this that I'm not sure a lot of people are aware of, because you don't really come into contact with these issues unless you do what I did and what some other people have do, investigative reporting, and actually go down there and take a look directly at what's happening. So yeah, I mean, in the last decade or so, as we all know, the drug trade has become a major issue in Mexico. It was always an important aspect of life there, but now I think it has become a lot worse as the pressure was put on Colombia. A lot of that kind of migrated to Mexico. And of course, that aspect of Mexican life inevitably became kind of intertwined with other aspects of other illegal trades, as it were. And among them, of course, inevitably, immigration, because that is an illegal trade. There's a whole business, you could call it, that's been built on illegal immigration. As one would expect, whenever there's a big illegal trade involved, you would expect a big sort of business to grow out of that. So that's kind of now become entangled with the narco trade. So you do see in many of these routes that used to be completely monopolized by the migration trade, now a very strong narco presence. And to make things even more interesting, the Catholic Church has now become also a part of this. Mainly for humanitarian reasons. I mean, the Catholic Church is very strong in Mexico. They have always been very close to immigrants or migrants from Mexico to the United States. And they always were a presence at the border. But in this case, they're not only, of course, involved in humanitarian work trying to help immigrants, they're also now becoming in many ways their protectors, and they have seen themselves involved in a really kind of ironic, it's a really sort of ironic twist of history. They've seen themselves involved in negotiations with the drug cartels so they could just kind of guarantee or get guarantees from them for the safety of the immigrants to whom they are attached, and I saw this for myself. So this is all going on now in along the border between Mexico and the United States, and it's a really kind of unexpected and fascinating aspect of this.
Oh, sure. I mean, it's a whole other discussion as to what to do about the drug trade and things like that. But one thing that I got from part of your writing was that the involvement of the church in trying to help people, and I think anyone with any kind of compassion would understand that, of course, you know, when people are dying on these journeys, that, you know, of course somebody like the church and these people who care about you know, these people are going to step in and try to do what they can to help them. But it's something that's happened historically, as you pointed out, whether it was in Europe or other places. This isn't anything new. It's been happening as you've had migration and immigration in parts of the world for, you know, centuries.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not only that, I would say you see that even in the United States. I mean, the Catholic Church in the U.S. has always been very close to immigrants, and that is still the case. And it makes a lot of sense, of course. About three-quarters of the immigrants that come in these days are Catholic. About one-fourth are Protestant, by the way. And it's interesting that all those Catholic immigrants, they call themselves born again, with the language don't usually associate with Catholicism. It's more associated with Protestant churches. So it's kind of, it's becoming a very interesting aspect as well. But that's another issue. The situation really is such that the church here has become very close to immigrants and very immigrants, and of course on humanitarian grounds. And it's been the case that occasionally governments have approached the church when they've tried to, when they've been involved in discussions about what to do with immigration. They have involved the Catholic Church in those discussions, simply because they are probably the institution that at this point is closest to them in the country.
You know, Alvaro, this is an angle that I wanted to just explore slightly more, because if you look at it from a breakdown of, let's say, you have the political view, you have the humanitarian view, and then let's say you have the sort of security slash legal view, the challenge that I see here is it's hard from a church or any religious institution's perspective to not do all they can to help. But, of course, you can't ignore the sort of tipping the lifeboat theory. And so with that in mind, do you see there being perhaps greater outreach or support to, or a more forceful approach from the Catholic Church in particular, both to help work with the U.S. for, let's say, visa laws that would be more effective than just violating borders, and at the same time to work with the Mexican government to help reduce corruption and many of the things that are making so many folks want to head north of the border in the first place?
Well, I think one way in which they could be really helpful is in doing away with mistrust. That is a big part of this now. Just thinking about the executive that President Obama said a few days ago, one of the questions there is really how many people are actually going to come forward and apply for these permits. The press is talking very freely about 4 million plus people, but we don't know that's going to happen. A big part of that is going to be prospect of, you know, somebody coming in to visit a couple of years from now and deciding they want to change the rules, or the prospect of never having an actual law in place, and therefore always being in a kind of permanently precarious situation. So we don't know that. I think the church could play a huge role in building more trust among the immigrant community. Another issue that I think is very important also is really kind of more political probably than anything else, and it's the issue that you mentioned. I think the Mexican authorities and the Mexican government are inevitably going to be a part of the equation, and the dialogue with the Mexican authorities is probably, at least in some respects, best left to institutions that are both trusted across the border and trusted by immigrants themselves. Because when you establish a dialogue between the authorities in the United States and the authorities in Mexico over this, there is always a tendency to be defensive. There's always a mistrust there as well. There's obviously a huge political angle to this, domestically, on both sides. And this makes a solution really difficult to reach. I think the Catholic Church, I know they have played occasionally a role in this, but I think they could probably see that role enhanced if there was more awareness on both sides, but probably more on this side of the border, about how instrumental they could be in reaching a solution. Of course, you have to start by being constructive about this on both sides. In other words, you need to want to achieve a solution. It's not been possible to get into that kind of frame of mind in recent years because this has become such a hot political football here in the U.S. and in some respects in Mexico too, but I would say even more over here, that there hasn't been really kind of room for thinking more kind of long-term and trying to see what kind of institutions, including the church, could help, bridge that gap.
Alvaro, I noticed that, you know, it seems numerous administrations, even going back to Reagan and you know, to be honest, I didn't really pay attention to politics until Carter and Reagan, so that's about as far back as I go. But, you know, we had the, in 1986, you had the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which brought a lot of help to, you know, and you made this argument, had a great impact on the agricultural industry. But ever since then, you've had several presidents who've tried, in some ways we have had, you know, whatever you want to call it, but whether you want to call it amnesty or whatnot, but they've tried to have different types of immigration reform from time to time. And in particular, you have George W. Bush and now the Obama administration who both ran and campaigned on the issues, but also they've met a lot of resistance from, you know, and you called it a strong movement within the United States. And I think there are some legitimate concerns and reasons why there is resistance. But if we can now shift our focus to the concerns on both sides, what are some of the legitimate concerns that we have that would want to limit the amount of immigration and types of reform? But then on the other hand, what are some of the positives and things that call for immigration reform? And then after that, I'd like to get into what you believe are some of the best options for trying to reform the system that we currently have.
Sure. I mean, the essential problem here is that there is a disconnect between the law and reality. And I think that's something that both sides of this debate should really come to terms with. It's really important to understand that because in any society, when there is a disconnect between the law and reality, what tends to happen is a big community of people is left out or is just left sort of on the margins of that society. But if that is a tiny amount of people, a tiny number of people, it doesn't become a huge social issue. But if it's a massive number of people, it does. And eventually, you have to come to terms with that. And that means you need to understand that there's something in the law that is clearly obstructing the kind of the path towards the solution. That's, I think, really the starting point. We may disagree about where we want to go. We may disagree about the specifics of the changes we want to make. But if we don't accept that reality, we won't get anywhere. And unfortunately, a lot of people, for understandable reasons, haven't come to terms with that. When I hear people say something that, by the way, is absolutely true, people say, well, you cannot reward because the society falls on a set of rules, and the rule of law cannot simply accept, you know, disobeying the law. As a statement per se is, of course, something nobody in their right state of mind should object to. It's obvious that a society based on the rule of law needs to have rules in place that need to be obeyed by everybody. However, if we start from that standpoint, we will never come to the fact that there has been this that has created this huge social problem that now means 10 to 11, 12 million people, depending on what time we're talking about are in the shadows, and it's a growing number. I mean, this could become even worse in the near future. So I think that's really the starting point. We need to accept that there needs to be an effort on the part of the people who make the rules to accommodate a reality that is so powerful, people might fall massively at risk for taking their lives, but also on this side, an entire economic system is in many ways dependent upon that stream, that flow of people into the economy. So that, I think, is a really important issue. Now, this doesn't always take the exact same shape. It really varies on the early part of the 2000 decade, when you had an economy that was booming. In some cases, part of that, of course, was the bubble itself, but it's a different issue. There was a huge need for the economy.
Avar, even when the society is booming, though, there's still a disconnect sometimes between the skill sets required and the skill sets that are coming. But I wanted to sort of transition. You made a very interesting comment that, you know, sort of speaks to social dissonance, if you will. And it struck me as I was listening to you that this is akin to our Prohibition era here, where the 18th and the 21st Amendments, which created and repealed prohibition, was really the 21st Amendment was nothing other than an acceptance that the law was so disconnected to reality that it had to change. And I think there is some reasonable area here to debate. However, I would point out that I still think it's very important that we reconnect quotas and skill sets with we've always had quotas and we've always had some room for humanitarian immigration. So I wanted to get your opinion on where that conversation is going right now, again, going back to quotas, where we decide how many people and from what countries and what targeted skill sets we're looking for, because that seems to be an art that in the last 20, 25, 30 years has gone away, and it was very important to help build this nation.
Well, that's a really good point. In the last century or so, the people who reformed the system, because there were a few attempts at reform, didn't take reality into account. You had in the early part of the century a system that was set in place in the 1920s, and those quotas were mostly based on the national origin of the immigrants, and it was a system obviously skewed towards protecting the balance between immigrants from Northern Europe and immigrants from Southern Europe who were coming in big numbers at the time. Then the system was reformed in the 60s, and that changed to a quota system based more on hemispheres than actual countries. So that's when you saw the beginning of a I would say a Latin Americanization, if you will, of the immigrant community, and so on and so forth. There was an attempt last year to pass a law in Congress. It was the bill was only approved in the Senate, as you probably know, which was could have been improved on and certainly debatable. But for the first time in a very long time, there was an effort to establish some quotas that were more realistic and also more flexible, which is another point I was making before, which is the economy, of course, goes from boom to bust, and it goes through different phases, and the needs of the economy obviously vary according to what time in the cycle you find yourself in. So all of that needs a certain degree of flexibility. In that bill, there were a number of interesting aspects, including the fact that some of the quotas, it was basically kind of divided into tier one, tier two, and so on and so forth. And there were different quotas with different ceilings according to the needs of the economy. established at that point. And I think something along those lines is probably a lot more realistic than the situation we have now, whereby you neither have the right number of low-skilled immigrants nor the right number of high-skilled immigrants. Even in the executive order signed by President Obama, you still have a situation developing in which the needs of the economy are not going to be matched by a sufficient supply of high-skilled immigrants, which is something that a lot of the high-tech companies are talking about now.
Yeah. Alvaro, you just mentioned the executive order that the president just set forth. And one of the issues I have with that is, if you're going to address the issue of what to do with people who are here illegally, then we should do so in a way that's more of a permanent manner. In other words, and that's not to say I agree with what the president did, but to me, if you just do a temporary fix where it might give them a status for a few years, but then it's an issue all over again, that's not really a solution. It's just kind of kicking the can down the road. The other thing is, if you're going to do anything, I don't understand why he just decided to randomly say, okay, let's do it with 5 million and not address all of the people who are here.
Yeah, no, of course, and not only that, but if you make such a strong moral defense in the way he did, of the executive order, then what happens to the people who came in as children illegally after 2010, who are left out of this? In other words, during the Obama administration, what is the reason behind that? Obviously, there must be a legal reason. I'm sure the lawyers have been working at different ways to get around the law, and I'm sure there's a legal aspect to this. But in any case, if this is moral and political, and the president has made this moral and political, it's a perfectly legitimate question. You know, is it if it's immoral to split families apart, why is that not the case for families that are going to be split apart if the child came into the country after 2010? That's one aspect. The other more important aspect, I think, is exactly the one you mentioned, which is that this is not a permanent solution. Not only that, but it's the people who will apply for a permit will not, I mean, they will do so in the knowledge that they will not be able to apply for citizenship and that the permit will be temporary. In other words, you know, 3-4 years from now, they will find themselves in exactly the same situation they find themselves in now. And everything will really hinge on what kind of administration comes into office after 2016. So all of that obviously creates a lot of uncertainty and certainly far removed from anything we might call a permanent solution. Unfortunately, it's a perfect reflection of where the debate is right now, and it's just impossible to come up with anything that's a permanent solution. I mean, it really is quite sad.
Oh, well, it is, because it's, you know, like I said, it seems that Washington, regardless of who's doing it, is very good at passing problems down the road and not really coming up with viable solutions. But I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't bring this up. But I think we do have to mention all of the people around the world, regardless of where they're coming from, who apply to come to the United States through the immigration process. And how do we deal with those people who see action being taken for people who gained illegal access as compared to the ones who are waiting in long lines and going through the whole process and doing and trying to follow the law? How do we square that?
Well, the honest answer is you don't. The honest answer is because they let the problem take on this colossal dimension, somebody is going to have to pay a price and somebody is going to have to be sacrificed in the search for a solution. And that's going to be probably the people that you mentioned, the people who have gone through the channels of the law and of the system. But if that's going to be a reason not to do anything, eventually we're going to turn up in a much worse situation. Ideally, once you establish a system that's realistic, meaning that the number of applications will probably match the number of the needs of the economy and the needs of society and what the country can accommodate. What you will see is probably 95% of the people wanting to come here going through the same channels. But between now and then, there is obviously a gap that's going to have to be filled by probably an unjust solution, if that's the way we're going to look at it. Yes, I mean, those people are going to be obviously the people who have been, you know, waiting for a response from the government, who applied maybe a few years ago. Those people, of course, are going to feel that this is not fair on them. I don't see how you solve that problem other than simply expediting their applications without in turn creating an even worse problem, because you know you do have 11 million people who are in the shadows right now, and something needs to be done about that. And even worse than that, you know, this could become really a 20 million people problem if nothing is done. I mean, imagine the economy really picking up in the next 2 or 3 years. You will see a huge demand for workers, and that will eventually reflect itself on the numbers coming in. I mean, it's always been like that. It's in the last, until 2007, 2008, the number of undocumented immigrants coming in was very big, about between 500,000 and 800,000 every year. After that, it dropped dramatically, and in fact you had a very interesting situation with net out migration, in other words more people leaving than coming in, and that's why it's no longer true that there are 12 million people who are undocumented in the country. It's probably more like 10.5 to 11 million. But that's not going to last forever. I mean, it really depends on the environment. If the environment changes, it's going to change again. So really the problem right now is not so much those 11 million or so, but the next 10 million, the next 12 million, if nothing is done about this on a permanent basis.
Havara, if we want our children and grandchildren to experience a second American century, we cannot do that without two things. One, a continuation of the American innovative culture that helped to make us successful, but two, we need a population that can support it, right? With countries like China and India on the rapid rise, and Brazil and others growing, you know, we need a strong population, or else we'll just become like many of the European powers. With that in mind, immigration being very important, who are either countries abroad that you would say, quote unquote, have gotten it right? And at the same time, who are the honest brokers that we could look at maybe within our own political system who can transcend the political nonsense and permanent voting blocks versus, you know, hardcore restrictions to really find a settlement that works for this country, not for any one individual in particular, but really works as a cohesive plan for a new American century?
Well, those are two very important questions. On the first one, I would say there are a number of countries that in different periods of time got it mostly right. I mean, Canada and Australia are the two countries that come to mind most often. Those countries have kind of started to change the rules in the last few years, mostly because of the political pressure that's also been taking place in those countries. But they had very flexible systems that basically meant most people would go through the law, through the system, and they would, you know, in most cases, get a positive answer from the government. And so this kind of tendency developed for the system to be kind of flexible on a permanent basis. That has changed in recent years, but I think it worked fine. You also had in Europe, after the Second World War, an interesting situation because the economy, of course, started to change very dramatically and became very mechanized, and that led to a need for a lot of sort of low-skilled workers. So many countries, including Germany and France and Spain, established kind of really ongoing relationships based on this, with source countries for immigrants. In other words, countries from where they could import immigrants. So you had Germany making deals with Turkey, you had France making deals with Algeria, you had Spain making deals with Morocco, and coming up with numbers of people that they thought were needed. They took a kind of close look at the economy and realized they needed a certain number of people, and they made deals with those countries that I mentioned, so that every year you would have X number of people migrating from one place to the other, and that worked reasonably well for a number of years in Europe. I would say the 60s, the 70s, and so on. And you also had, interestingly enough, kind of deals happening between European countries themselves. So you had Germany and Spain, for instance, or Switzerland and Spain, making deals. At the time, Spain was an underdeveloped country, so it was a source country for migrants as well. So that kind of worked reasonably well. In some Latin American countries, there's been some of that in the recent past. So I mean, there are experiences that the U.S. could draw from, but eventually, I think the solution is going to have to be obviously.
Right.
It's unrealistic that this will happen without going through the two major parties. And probably the best way to go about this is to look for the right people in those parties. I mean, there are people on both sides of the aisle who want a solution. Even in the Republican Party, there are a number of people who have been pushing for reform, who realize that it's not realistic to take a purely negative stance, and who just think that politically is not good for the party, just as I think the Democrats and the president realized that because they did nothing in recent years, they were beginning to pay a price. In the last elections, only about 8% of the total number of voters was Hispanic, which was a low number because in the previous election, the number was the percentage was more like 10. And the number of Hispanics who voted for the Republicans in this election was high compared to the previous election. Obviously, it was still much more than, but still, it was an important kind of signal to the president. So politics and electoral politics plays a huge deal. But I mean, maybe it's a factor that can kind of help concentrate the minds of the right people on both sides of the aisle. If the solution is not going to, it's not going to come from outside the political system, unfortunately, it's going to have to come from the political system. So I think we're better off trying to persuade or work with people who are in the right frame of mind on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, no, it's a fair point. And you answered a few things I was going to ask. But I just want to say this, and I think you're right. I think part of the reason why there has been really no movement on this issue for, I would say towards the end of the Bush administration, but also the entire Obama administration, is because there's a lack of trust between, the president has already demonstrated his willingness to just almost do what he wants when he wants with regards to other types of legislation. And he's already, created bad will with the Republicans in the way he's gone about his business. So it's been a very difficult environment for the Republicans to sit down with them. But I also want to bring up one thing, because I happen to be aware of several different types of bills that the Republicans in the House have brought up over time dealing with issues from the worker visas, which we've discussed, but also border security. And I think that unless those kind of issues are dealt with, it's easy to point fingers from whether, the Senate points a finger at the House or the President at the Congress or whoever. But unless they address the issues that concern both sides, there won't be a political solution. And then after that, you had a chapter that you discussed at great length, do immigrants cost more than they contribute? And I think that's an important, if we could just end up our discussion today with that, because I think there are a lot of very interesting facts that you'd pointed out.
Sure. That's a really important part of this debate, and there's a lot of, I think, frankly, myth that's been built on misinformation or just partial information. The truth is that immigrants do pay a lot of taxes. They, of course, mostly local and state taxes. But not only that, I mean, at least $7 billion a year are paid in Social Security taxes by immigrants who are not supposed to have a Social Security. I mean, that's one of the ironies of the system. And in many respects, it's very hard to talk about exact numbers when, you know, half of immigrant households have at least one child who is an American citizen. So where do you draw the line exactly? But there's been a number of very interesting studies, and perhaps most notably by the National Research Council, that a few years ago made a very interesting projection. And what they said is they looked at what would happen if undocumented immigrants became legal and worked for the next 50 years, taking into account that most of them are very young and that they could probably be expected to work for another 50 years. So what they calculated was the net present value of both what they would contribute and what they would take out of the system, without taking into account how much the economy would grow because of them. In other words, being extremely conservative. And the net number for each one of them was a positive $80,000. In other words, they contributed more than they took out of the system, about a net $80,000. And there's been another, you know, other studies that have concluded that the contribution will be a net positive. But as I say, I mean, the real number is likely to be higher than that, because you have to take into account that once you incorporate into an economy so many working people, you're going to make that economy larger because of specialization and the division of labor, and that in turn is going to create conditions for higher revenues for the government. Unfortunately, this is not really a statistical discussion; it's more of a political and in some respects a psychological discussion. So it's
sure.
hard to persuade people with these numbers.
No, absolutely. You know, I'll just throw something out. In New Jersey, we pay an average of, you know, close to $16,000 per student for just education, and in some cities it's upwards of $30,000. So, and in some of these communities that pay even more, they have you know, children of illegal immigrants who are, you know, now citizens who attend the schools. So if you have somebody who's using a high cost, but perhaps they're parents aren't paying taxes because of the situation that they're in, that maybe it's wise to change that particular dynamic to get them to cover more of the cost. And so I could see arguments on both sides where there's an actual cost benefit to doing something. And also, when you look at healthcare, if somebody's able to just visit a regular doctor and have medical insurance as opposed to visiting a medical emergency room or things of that nature where it costs a lot more, I think there would be a cost savings to the health care industry as well.
Sure. I mean, one of the ironies, when you were talking just now, I was thinking about a study by the Cato Institute fairly recently, I think last year or even more recent than that. They looked at Medicaid, for instance, and if Medicaid is used by natives at the same rate as it is used by immigrants, the program would be about 40% smaller than it is than it is now. I mean, it's important to look at the reality and base the discussion and the search for the solution on the reality of you know, everyday life, because otherwise we become so caught up in these myths that it just becomes impossible to offer any kind of solution without falling into a political trap.
Absolutely. Alvaro, I'll give you the opportunity to make one last statement with regards to this issue or to your book, Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America.
Well, thanks very much for the opportunity and for having me. I think this is a really important discussion. If the executive order that was signed by the president a few days ago has you know, any validity, I think it's precisely that it's going to continue to create debate and discussion, and it's going to keep the issue alive. And I really hope this is not the end, but the beginning. I mean, the worst thing that could happen is that nobody does anything more, and that we find ourselves a few years from now really lamenting the fact that we didn't do anything in 2014. I really hope we can find a solution very, very soon.
That absolutely. Vera Vargas Llosa, thank you so much for joining us today. And, of course, you're with the Independent Institute, so I'll give you the opportunity to share the website for those folks. And if you have any Twitter feeds or Facebooks that you'd like to share as well.
Sure. It's www.independent.org, and the book Global Crossings can be acquired at the Institute or in any bookstore in the country. And we do have a Twitter and Facebook attached to the Institute with the same name. And I hope folks will check it out.
Great. Again, thank you so much for the time on such an important issue that it really impacts the entire country, and we have to have the debate and discussion, and that's the very fabric of this nation, debating the issue. So thank you, Ever. We really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Take care. Excellent interview, folks, with Alvaro Vargas Llosa, and excellent book. I do recommend it. It's very interesting, and there are a lot of historical references and, of course, notes and everything he says in here, is footnoted to other sources to help you try to formulate your own opinion on the various pieces of this issue and topic. And again, we thank him for joining us. And we continue with our program. Well, ladies and gentlemen, in addition to the immigration issue and some of the other things that are going on, I want to turn our attention to a couple, while we have, I guess about 8 minutes left in the program, a couple things in the news. Now, Chuck Hagel obviously put in his resignation, and so far, two of the candidates that we had already discussed have said no. Very interesting. And I'll tell you why. I mean, it's very simple. First of all, the two of the people that we'd brought up the other day when we discussed this, Senator Jack Reed and Michelle Flournoy, both of them have already taken their names off the list before they even had a chance to be asked, at least publicly. So, that's very interesting because they were probably two of the better, not that I would say they're the best candidates, but as far as the ones that would be put forward. So that's very interesting to me and in a sense troublesome. But how could you blame any of these people from not wanting to take this post? Now, it's one thing to want to serve your country. It's another to be put in a position where you're going to absolutely be thrown under the bus, and you're being put in a situation where it's a no-win, and it could really damage your future career. I mean, this president has no idea what he's doing with regards to any of the situations that are occurring around the world, whether it be Iran, Ukraine, Syria, with ISIS, China, Russia, you name it. He just has no idea what to do. He's getting himself in deeper. He's not responding to any of the threats in a serious or coherent manner. And you're supposed to take over for that. And in the meantime, if you don't do what the White House wants you to do, they're going to just throw you under the bus. So either way, you're going to take the fall. So why would you want to be put in that situation? So this is a terrible, terrible position for the country to find itself in. And, of course, this is exactly the kind of argument that we had made when this clown was running for re-election, and we said, you got to get rid of him. He's not up to the task. It's very dangerous what's going on here. And, well, such is life. Now we have to live with it. So another military issue was, and something that was a problem for Hagel, the release of these five extreme terrorists to get Bo Bergdahl back. And believe it or not, it's 5 months ago already, but the military has yet to release a report on Bergdahl leaving his Afghanistan post in 2009. And this report is to make recommendations of whether he should be punished. The Pentagon says is not holding up the decision, though the review by Army General Kenneth Dahl was finished in early October. So let me think about this. It is now November 26th. They're saying that the General Dahl had finished this report in early October. I know the president's busy partying it up and you know, campaigning and doing all the other important things he does, like golf. But I'm sure he could have read the report where it could have been issued, or whoever's supposed to read the report, right? So anyway, Rear Admiral John Kirby, who's the Pentagon press secretary, recently acknowledged the report has been completed and said it is under review. Of course it's under review. Okay, so as you know, it's in the building. That can sometimes take a while, especially for a major investigation like this. Of course, they're waiting for the right time. Anyway, this is interesting. Desertion in the military is technically a punishable offense, punishable by death. And but given the circumstances of Bergdahl's case, such a sentence is essentially out of the realm of possibility. Well, I don't know why that is. Bergdahl, the only American prisoner in the war in Afghanistan, could face a lesser administrative punishment, including forfeiture of back pay or even jail time. But Army officials are acutely aware of the potential political backlash. Oh, come on. Backlash that could be follow the severe punishment of a prisoner of war. Freak. Are you serious? You know, this is the problem. And this is the problem. But I don't know what to say. I really don't know. How many men and women in the armed forces, how many of them died trying to find Bergdahl? People gave their lives trying to find this guy who just went AWOL. And amongst other things he did. Plus, we had to release five extreme terrorists who are now wreaking havoc and responsible for the deaths of other people, as I predicted is happening. This is just absurd, and this man needs to be punished. And if they don't do so, the Army is sending the same type of message. Of course, I would expect them to do so. The same type of message that the Obama administration has sent, that it's okay to try to kill a cop. It's okay to, you know, burn down buildings. Just do it peacefully. The whole thing's a joke to me. The whole thing's an absolute joke. Anyway, I want to try to end this show on a good note. And, of course, I wish you all a happy Thanksgiving. You know, do yourselves a favor. Go pick up a little bit of book. Find out a little bit about what Thanksgiving is all about. It's not just about turkey. It's about a story of, you know, a story of America, really. You know, gives us a sense of how we came about here, the relationship we had with, you know, with Native Americans, and you know, the type of life and how it was like to live back then, and of course there was good and bad. You know, that's not for the whole discussion here, but I'm thankful. I'll tell you that I'm thankful. I'm an American. Despite the president we have, despite the problems we have, despite the Democratic Party that drives me absolutely up a wall, but I'm thankful that I have a gift, and that is called American citizenship. And I only wish that the people who live here and have that only appreciate it as much as the people who cross the border illegally and face the possibility of death and all the things that they go through to try to gain access to our country. If only the Americans who were here and had it already appreciated it the way they should, then maybe we would look at things just a little bit differently and go about our lives a little bit differently, and we would all give more, produce more. And as a result, we'd all have and share more and be a happier people and be better off for it. So that's what I have to say, and I wish all of you a very happy Thanksgiving. Please be careful. If you're traveling, be safe. Don't drive too fast. Obey the traffic laws. Get there safely, and do not drink and drive. Do not eat too much. That's a bad thing, too. And just enjoy the time with your family, and we'll be back again with you on Friday, as we are usually every Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. This is the Final Say Radio Show, Brett and John Rappaport. Wishing you a happy Thanksgiving, a very happy Thanksgiving, and thanks to all of our friends who always are there to support us.
The Final Say Radio Show is an original broadcast of Rappaport Media. To hear more The Final Say podcast, go to www.thefinalsay.com.